Won't be clapping at the end. Start off by saying it's good to see so many people here so early on a Saturday morning. I could say for a start that I think that's some evidence to support my case already. You know, human beings getting out of bed early on a Saturday morning. We're not all lazy after all. But I wanted to start off today with a quote from the Marxist literary theorist and philosopher Walter Benjamin. According to Benjamin, there's no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. And looking at the history of human civilization over the last 300 years or so, it's easy to see why he would come to such a conclusion. During this time, we've seen, among other things, the forcible enslavement of tens of millions of people, the dispossession and ongoing brutalization of countless indigenous communities, endless wars that have laid waste to large swathes of the land and people of the globe, the rapidly accelerating destruction of the environment, and the boundless viciousness of oppression in all its forms. So, all in all, it's not a very pretty picture. And based on a track record like this, we may well conclude, as American novelist Mark Twain famously did, that it's a pity that Noah didn't miss the boat. The question then is, how did it all go so wrong? The idea that human nature is to blame for this is the easy answer, I think. According to this view, humanity is little more than a personal blooper reel for a higher power. We're hardwired, so the story goes, to be violent, greedy, selfish, and lazy. The more we have, the more we want. We're power-hungry and easily corrupted by the trappings of prosperity. And even the seemingly most idealistic of us will inevitably betray our principles if we ever actually get into a position to put them into place. And given that we're all inherently racist, sexist, and homophobic, and anything else you care to name, then it's not likely that we're going to be very idealistic in the first place. Seen in this way, the mystery lies less in where we went wrong than with how we actually managed to survive up to this point. But while there's no doubt that the last few hundred years have seen more than their fair share of unpleasantness, the real and all too often obscured bedrock of society is actually much more about working cooperatively with others, generally caring for people, than you would think. To start off with, just look at the sacrifices that people are prepared to make for their immediate friends and family. I think it's simply not the case that we make decisions purely based on our own narrow self-interest. We all make decisions on an everyday basis based on what we think, you know, the others who are in our lives, who we care about, what they think, what their views are. And to do anything else other than that, you know, there are people who do that, but we tend to regard them as, you know, being mentally ill or inhuman. And even when it comes to those who we don't know personally, it's not as if our first instinct is simply to trample over them in the pursuit of our interests. Think of the response to Victoria's recent bushfire disaster, for example. I'm a public servant who works for the Victorian state government, and following the bushfires, I was redeployed from my role to help actually contact the massive number of people who are getting in touch with the government to volunteer their services to help with the bushfire recovery. And the government actually got a bit panicked and started worrying that it was going to end up looking bad because it had really no mechanism to actually get these people who were volunteering to the help that, to where they needed, the help was needed. So, you know, it was a really massive response. And the same spirit of solidarity can be seen in countless other cases. The Asian tsunami of 2004 comes to mind, just in case you were thinking that it's all just about Australians. And then there's the millions of dollars that people donate every single year to charities, and, you know, working class people in particular, I think statistics show, donating a lot of their income to charity. Another aspect of our everyday existence that's clearly in breach of our supposed constitution as selfish brutes is the amount of cooperation that's involved. And an example of this which has always fascinated me, and I don't know if other people share my view, but the postal system. The other day I posted a card to my uncle who lives on the south coast of England, and, you know, I just went outside the post office, put it in a small box. A week later, this same card turns up outside his house in a tiny box on outside his house on the south coast of England. You know, it seems like it happens all automatically, but the reality of it is that it's people cooperating around the world to get this done. If everyone was just doing their own thing, this wouldn't happen. And if we go beyond the wonders of the postal system to the entire global economy, you can see how much cooperation is actually integral to every aspect of our lives. So on the one hand, we live in a society where selfishness, greed, and violence and oppression are an all too common reality. But on the other hand, we can see that to a large extent, our lives are anchored in completely opposite kinds of behavior. And so in order to try and understand what's going on here, I'm going to talk a bit now, quite a lot, about how Marx understood the question. So in contrast to the more religiously minded philosophers and thinkers of his time, and also the pseudo-scientific conjectures, more contemporary disciplines like sociobiology, the starting point for Marx's discussion of human nature was how human beings have actually lived and behaved at different points in history. And looking at this, we can see, first of all, that humans have a particular set of basic needs that form the bedrock. They are constant, and they form the bedrock of society in whatever form it happens to take. We have a need, for example, for food, clothing, shelter, and the care of assistance of other human beings. If we didn't have those things, we wouldn't last very long. But the most striking feature of humanity that Marx identified lay in our use of tools of various kinds and our constant drive to shape the world around us to better suit our needs. And that's what, according to Marx, first distinguished humans from the animals from which we evolved. Our increasing use of tools led to a shift away from a shift towards a more upright posture that freed up our hands and enabled a dexterity that's way beyond the movements that can be made by even the most human-like primates. And as the complexity of our labour increased, so too did the forms of communication required to carry it out. And so language thus emerged as a means by which the community could more effectively coordinate the labour that it was required to survive. And with language came a self-awareness, a critical consciousness that represented a qualitative leap out of the realm of necessity, of innate and unconscious drives and instincts, and into the realm of freedom, where humanity could actually start to choose how it wanted to live and how best to meet its needs. As Marx wrote in the 1844 manuscripts, conscious life activity directly distinguishes humanity from animal life activity. So this represents the defining characteristic of human existence as Marx understands it. And I want to make it clear that I think Marx did have a theory of human nature. He didn't just believe that we're all entirely malleable. Marx thought that we are beings who, in contrast to animals, have not only a propensity to labour, but the capacity to labour freely and creatively to shape our world and to control our interaction with nature in a way that reflects who we think we are and how we want to live. But having said this much, we're still quite away from understanding the specifics of human behaviour at any given point in time. What the historical record tells us is that while collective labour to meet our needs has been the common thread linking societies right from the emergence of human beings in Africa right through to today, the particular forms this labour has taken and the norms of behaviour that have gone with it have been far from constant. And it's in relation to this point that I think Marx's most famous statement on the question of human nature should be understood. In the thesis on Feuerbach, Marx wrote that the human essence is no abstraction inherent in each single individual. In its reality, it is the ensemble of social relations. Now, this doesn't mean that Marx thought our nature was completely malleable, so I want to make that clear from the start. What he did think, though, was that the particular characteristics of humanity at any given point in time can only be understood with reference to the kind of society in which they live. A few years later, in the German ideology, we get a slightly different take on what I think is essentially the same point. According to Marx, it's not consciousness that determines being, but social being that determines consciousness. So, social being, okay, the kind of social being that prevails in a particular historical period depends on two main factors. One is the level of technological development, what in Marx's terms would be called the material forms of production. In the process of using tools to shape the world around us and to satisfy our basic wants and needs, we also change ourselves. Think, for example, how much the development recently of the internet and mobile phones has changed the way that we communicate and interact with others in almost every aspect of our lives. And if you multiply this into the thousands for, you know, all the developments that we made, you can see how different the outlook of people living today would be to those who, you know, were around even like 50 years ago. And then there's developments on the level of social relations. These are the forms of organisation of society and the relationships that hold between its members that define the way in which the material forms of production are set to work. It's the kind of social relations that exist in a particular society that underlie the cultural, ideological, and political life of that society. Now, I'm going to have to quickly go through history because there's been a lot of different forms of social relations throughout history, but I just want to talk about a couple of these. The biggest jump in relation to this took place around 10,000 years ago when society started to be divided into classes. Prior to that, humans had lived in small communities that in today's terms would probably be labelled communist. The products of labour were shared among the members of the community based on need, and the idea that some people should be getting a larger portion than others, or that individuals should be regarded as having ownership over things, would have seemed absurd. And there's a lot of evidence for this from studying indigenous communities around the world. Now, I'm going to leap a long way forward now to capitalism itself. And the emergence of capitalism as a dominant world system through a series of revolutionary upheavals that punctuate the 18th and 19th centuries. Events such as the French Revolution that began in 1789 signalled the attempt by the emerging capitalist class to sweep away the fetters placed on them by the supposedly God-given rights of the feudal aristocracy. The system was born, as Marx put it, dripping from head to toe in blood and dirt. The rapidly expanding wealth and power of the capitalists was built up on the back of the slave trade, the brutality of colonial conquest, and the super-exploitation of workers at home and abroad. When looked at from the perspective of humanity's ongoing development through history in terms of our relationship with nature and all of those other things that are basic for humans, it was nevertheless a step forward, a very contradictory one, but a step forward. In contrast to feudal lords who frittered away the surplus product of society in ever more grotesque displays of luxury and indulgence, the capitalists were forced through competition with their rivals to invest their profits back into the system in a never-ending quest for more increased productivity and efficiency. But of course, the progressive element of capitalism has long since disappeared. I mean, long since, you know, way back in the 19th century. We've now reached the point, for the first time in history, where the potential exists for everyone to have a decent standard of living without thereby being limited to a life of an unending toil. On the basis of the rapid development of the productive potential of humanity that's occurred under capitalism, we can now live in a society in which everyone has a chance to fully realise what Marx sees as their essence in the free, creative and collective endeavour of shaping the world to best meet our needs. The social relations of capitalism, which started as a spur to development, have now become a fetter. And this is reflected quite clearly, I think, in the fact that the ideologies put forward to support the system have been transformed over time from right at the start being geared towards mobilising the broader population for change, towards actually crushing the spirit of that population to maintain the status quo. The capitalist system begins with the Declaration of the Rights of Man of liberty, equality and fraternity. It ends with the idea that we're all selfish brutes whose lives need to be policed and controlled at every turn and who deserve every injustice that the system dishes out to us. And the ruling class of today, whose wealth and power comes from the exploitation of the labour of the working class, rely on ideologies such as this in order to maintain their position in the face of the obvious inability of their system to meet our basic needs. And I think we want to be really, really clear on this point, that capitalism absolutely crushes and destroys the humanity of the vast majority of the world's population. As American socialist Elizabeth Tzarkas has written, "Far from being naturally adapted to capitalism, most humans are battered and broken by it. If it doesn't straight out kill them, it stunts their physical and mental development. Their intellects are neglected. Their artistic talents remain undiscovered or unappreciated. And the distinctively human capacity to engage in creative, socially useful work is reduced to a commodity only as much as the capitalist can pay and still turn a profit. So I think it's in this light that the idea that human nature is to blame for all the horrors of society should be seen. Not as something that's based on any kind of objective analysis, but as a necessary adjunct to the social relations of a system that pits a minority ruling class against the majority of exploited workers. To maintain their rule, the capitalists have to ensure that the dissatisfaction that people feel with their lives, that, you know, everyday grinding down that the system puts people through, the violence, the racism, sexism, all of that, that rather than leading to a challenge to the system, this sense of despair, it's this sense of frustration is pushed along the safer channels for the capitalists of hopelessness and despair. And the promotion of the idea that human nature is inherently nasty and brutish is, I think, one of the most effective ways in which they've been able to do this. So in sum then, I just want to quote French Enlightenment philosopher Denis Diderot, who had a lot of insights, I think, coming right at the start of capitalism in that revolutionary period, who once said that it's not human nature we should accuse, but the despicable conventions that pervert it. So the next thing I want to talk about is how we can actually break through the barriers that have been put up by convention and ideology and the structure of our society and get back on the path to a society in which we actually have the potential to actually fulfill our basic nature and our needs. So I think it's clear that for the most part, people accept the basic parameters of the current system and the norms of behaviour that go with it. And this can hardly be surprising. In our everyday lives, we're confronted with the reality of capitalism in which such things as greed, competitiveness and violence can seem entirely natural. To succeed in a society that's defined by exploitation, war, and oppression requires no small measure of ruthlessness. And just to make sure that we get the message, we're also subject to a barrage of ideological distortions through the capitalist ownership of what Marx calls the means of mental production, the education system, the media, and so on. As Marx so succinctly put it in the German ideology, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. But there's another aspect of our lives under capitalist society. It tends to undermine the stability of this ideological edifice, and which explains the contradictory nature of our behaviour that I discussed earlier. And this tendency is based on the material conditions of our existence, the way in which the productive forces of society are organised, and the fundamental conflict of interest between the working class, whose labour creates all the wealth of society, and the capitalist class who benefit from it. I've already commented on the extent to which the current system requires a huge amount of cooperation to function, the postal system, all the other things that you can think of. And most of the time, this remains as a kind of collective unconscious that's obscured by the prevailing ideologies of competition and individual performance. But when workers start to fight for their own interests, it can actually quickly start coming to the surface. The causes of the class struggle that's been a constant feature of capitalism from the start aren't really part of my brief in this talk. All I'll say for now, though, is that there can never really be peace between the classes in a situation where one class, the capitalist, is constantly looking for ways to squeeze the maximum amount of profit out of its workers at the minimum cost. And this is not a choice for them. It's a matter of life or death for them. They're competing with all the other capitalists who are trying to do the same thing. And if you want evidence for this, only need to look as far as what's happening in the current economic crisis, everywhere, but Pacific Brands in particular, sacking workers because they want to stay competitive. And confronted with capitalism's failure to meet their needs, with, for example, reductions in wages or the threat of unemployment, workers are driven to resist. And the primary means by which we're able to do this is to actually withdraw our labour to halt production and hence cut off the flow of capitalist profits at their source. But in order to be effective in doing this, we can't just act as individuals. For one worker to stop work at protests at their conditions is only likely to get them fired. When all workers in a particular workplace or industry stop work, it's a force that the capitalists can't afford to ignore. There's a lot of examples I could use, but just want to imagine for now, the impact of a strike in an industry like transport or energy. A strike by power workers in Victoria's Latrobe Valley could quickly lead to sustained blackouts across Melbourne, shutdowns in other industries, transport chaos, and a massive impact on the profits of the bosses. But when this happens, this raises the question of actually seeking solidarity from workers in other workplaces and industries. Strike action by workers in one industry or one workplace can often be defeated by employers through a strategy of isolation. But if their action is supported by other workers through financial contributions, refusal to cross picket lines, or solidarity strikes, then the cost to the bosses can increase to the point where their opposition crumbles. So collective action by workers reveals their power as a source of profits for the capitalists, and it also brings the need for cooperation to the fore. For strike action to be successful requires the participation of all workers. And this can actually start to break down the ideologies of competition and individual performance and, sexist, homophobic, racist ideas that are used by employers to actually keep their workforce divided. Now, I'm not denying that these ideas can definitely be found in all workplaces, but I just want to make the point that overcoming them is not primarily a matter for education from outside. Rather, it's through struggle that workers who may hold such views can start to see it's not actually in their interest to do so. And it helps if there are people there who are consciously political and against, say, sexism, racism, who can actually intervene to generalise political lessons of struggle. But it's not about education in that pure sense. The struggle itself is educating for workers, and I want to make that clear. And collective action can also ultimately point the way to a totally new way of organising society. When strike action escalates to the point where the functioning of society is significantly impacted, the question arises as to how the basic services that workers need to survive can continue to be provided. And in this context, the organising committees and other elected bodies that initially emerged to coordinate the strike action can start to turn their attention to how you can actually restore these services. And when, under the democratic control of workers, the productive forces of society start to be turned towards providing the working class with what they need, without regard for the profits of the capitalists, the possibility of a fundamental shift in social relations is put firmly on the agenda. So what we're talking about now is revolution, and I'm sure you'll hear a lot about that at this conference, a process whereby the working class shakes loose the shackles that tie it to capitalism and the exploitation, violence, and oppression that drive it, and start running society in the interests of human need. And far from this being somehow against human nature, the testimony of participants in and witnesses to the many revolutions that dot the history of the 20th century show that they're characterised by a really powerful upsurge of human energy and creativity. So revolutions were really aptly, I think, described by Lenin as festivals of the oppressed. They're moments in history where the propensity of humans to engage with the future of society and the collective process of transformation of nature is liberated from the spirit-crushing reality of capitalism. And to give you a sense of this, it's worth quoting a couple of passages now. And the first one's from American journalist John Reed's first-hand account of the 1917 Russian Revolution. Describing the atmosphere in the city of Petrograd, which is at the centre of the revolutionary movement, Reed wrote the following. Lectures, debates, speeches, in theatres, circuses, schoolhouses, clubs, Soviet meeting rooms, union headquarters, barracks. Meetings in the trenches at the front, in village squares, factories. What a marvellous sight to see the Putilov factory pour out its 40,000 to listen to social democrats, socialist revolutionaries, anarchists, anybody. Whatever they had to say, as long as they would talk. For months in Petrograd and all over Russia, every street corner was a public tribune. And this account finds its echo in George Orwell's description of life in Barcelona in the months following the Spanish Revolution, 1936. And I think there's actually a talk on Orwell later in the conference. I recommend you go to if you have questions about why Orwell seems to be supporting socialism, but you don't think... Anyway... talk later. Orwell wrote that, so he's talking about Barcelona in the months following the Spanish Revolution. It was the first time that I'd ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying that it had been collectivised. Even the bootblacks had been collectivised and their boxes painted red and black. Waiters and shopwalkers looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. Down the Ramblas, the wide central artery of the town, where crowds of people streamed constantly to and fro, the loudspeakers were bellowing revolutionary songs all day and far into the night. Not so sure about that part. All this was queer and moving. There was much in it I did not understand, and in some ways I did not even like it. But I recognised it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. So that was Orwell in the Spanish Revolution. So we need to be clear, and I keep saying we need to be clear. There's a few things we need to be clear about. The next thing we need to be clear about is that revolutions are not an optional extra on the road to a socialist society. As Marx put it, revolution is necessary not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it, the working class, can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of the muck of ages, all that convention and ideology of capitalist society, and become fitted to found society anew. The power of a revolution lies in its ability to energise and inspire the mass of ordinary people to participate directly in the process of change. And it's only through such participation that the spirit of collective endeavour and engagement with the political and social life of society that provides a foundation for socialism can emerge. There's simply no way that a change of consciousness on such a massive scale can be brought about from change from the top down. So I pretty much have to wind up soon. So in conclusion, what we see in a revolution is an embryo of a radically different kind of society. A society in which the constant process of interaction between humanity and nature, the satisfaction of our wants and needs, and the creative process of development of ourselves and our world is freed from its ties to the profit system and turned into an end in itself. And I think this is something that can be really hard to imagine for those who, like us, are stuck within the everyday reality of capitalism. With the economic crisis raging around the world, one thing we can say for sure is that revolutions will continue to happen. Now, the question of what triggers them, how they can succeed, and how to prevent their failure and defeat at the hands of a resurgent ruling class has been covered in other talks in the conference hopefully people went to, so I'm not covering it today. But what I hope to have convinced you of is that human nature certainly isn't a barrier to radical change. Human beings are unique in their ability to adapt the way they behave to the social conditions that prevail at any given time. Nevertheless, there are certain natural propensities and basic needs that human beings have, and in relation to these, capitalism is a dramatic failure. For the capitalists to continue in their current privileged position, they need to maintain a facade of ideology that supports the status quo. And this includes the idea that humans are inherently selfish, greedy, and violent, and we've got the system that best reflects that. So our role, I think, as people who, you know, hopefully everyone here wants to change all that, is to participate in and encourage the struggles that are occurring today that tend to undermine these ideas and to point the way forward to a socialist society. So thank you.